Good evening, everybody. I really am delighted to see such a good turnout at the beginning of this course. I think thinking in an enterprising way is something that is good for everybody. So whether you do decide to go on and start your own business or just think a little bit more entrepreneurially, then I'll be delighted. It's my sort of mission in life to seduce people to the dark side of enterprise. So hopefully I'll have a stab at that tonight. So what is this all about? Well, the first thing is, you know, just to understand what we mean by business. And it's very simple. There is no rocket science here. A business is just simply an entity that sells things. So very, very simple. And to make it even more simple, there are only two things I believe you can sell, either a product or a service. There's nothing else. I mean, smart businesses sell both, but that's it. So the first thing you have to figure out really is what is it you're going to sell. Now, I would have to say, whether you have a business which you think of as a social enterprise or whatever it is, I really want you to focus on making a profit. A business, you know, is really there to make a profit. What you spend that money on, I'm professionally indifferent about. If you want to give it away to charity, then we've set one up for disabled entrepreneurs. You can give me a check tonight. If you want to spend it on cocktails in the Bahamas, try Johnny Canoes in Nassau. I don't care, but you have to make a profit. So don't go into business thinking that it's just about fun. It is about making a profit, but what you spend that on is entirely up to you. Now, one thing that I would say if you're thinking about your own career is that I would like you to think a little bit more about the different sources of revenue. So hands up those people who are, I know it's a horrible word, and don't be ashamed, but hands up those people who are employees. Anybody here? Okay, quite a few people. Don't worry. It's something that, you know, there's treatment available. Now, being an employee is a good thing, and I would certainly encourage all of you to be employees and all of you to take a salary from that employment. But don't just hold it there. I would encourage you to consider how you might access the other two forms of remuneration, one of them being profit sharing, number two on this list, or capital gain, by which I mean you make some money when the business for which you are working is sold. So tonight we'll be thinking a little bit later about a spin-out type of business, but a startup business that's going to be sold at some point in time where you have some ownership of shares and where you would therefore make some money when the business is sold. So three types of revenue, please, to be thinking about, not just salary, but there's nothing wrong with salary. You want to take that. Now, one thing that I would have to say to you is that if you are going to be part of a business that's raising equity finance, that is, that's getting money by selling shares, where investors buy shares in your business, then the day that you take the first check, when you sell the first share, that's the day you have to start thinking about selling the company. So it's a different way of thinking. And investors would typically want their money back. They're not making you a loan. When they come to sell the business, they want their money back plus quite a bit more in perhaps 5 years' time. So the duration of this process is not a lifetime. So you're starting a business with the express interest of selling it. And so it's a different kind of mindset. And so once you've done this once or twice, you then may have more than one business on the go at the same time. So really important to have a different way of thinking about all of this. So, is it complicated? No, it's really, really easy to start a business. Anybody could do it, unfortunately. It's very, very easy, and that's partly the problem. Unfortunately, the number of businesses registering and deregistering for VAT every year is pretty similar. So, the amount of going out of business and starting is very similar. It varies between sectors year on year, but it's very similar from those VAT statistics. And the Barclays SME Research Unit reckons that you'd be lucky to see 50% of businesses surviving more than 3 years. So just typical for Britain. We're really good at starting stuff, but hopeless in seeing it through to a success. And that's where we need to improve enormously. And for me, the best form of insurance against that type of problem, failure, is education. So simply being in the room tonight for this course over the coming weeks is a good place to start. So the more you can learn about enterprise, this process of business, then the greater the chance you will have of starting a business that becomes successful. So Is it hard? Yeah, it is. It is really, really hard. It's very, very difficult. You know, it's going to be one of those things where some days you really may well be working 24 hours a day. Other days, you know, you may well be, you know, discovering that the colour of fear is brown. You know, it depends how hard the bank manager is chasing you about the overdraft. So there are real problems associated with this. So don't be under any illusion. It is very, very difficult. So determination is one of the key things you need, and stamina. But I would say that in all of this, you need a good team. So entrepreneurship, people tend to think of that as being around an individual. But I don't really think that's true. I think really good entrepreneurs are people who've been successful in business more than once. Those who've been successful just once might be lucky, or they might be plumbers. I mean, have you ever met a poor plumber? So I think the key thing here is about knowing how to build a team and knowing what you need, and to some extent, knowing what you don't know and where your weaknesses lie and how those need to be plugged. So putting the team together requires you to get as much help and support as you can, and whatever you can get that's free at the outset is going to be beneficial. So is there a lot of good support around? Well, it's getting better, but my personal view is it's still nowhere near good enough. You know, with more than half of businesses failing in 3 years, that's a pretty poor indictment of what's available from the government and elsewhere. Not that long ago, I think 2002, there was a very interesting survey, large one, 18,500 businesses, I think Professor Carter et al. Published this, and they said that the good news is, of those people starting a business, 7 out of 10 people actively were seeking advice, and that's a good thing. But unfortunately, of those that found that advice, when the advice came from public sources, only 1 out of 10 was satisfied with the advice they got. But professional advisors shouldn't be complacent either, because equally, only 3 out of 10 people were satisfied with the service from other consultants. Now, I couldn't possibly comment on whether some of that dissatisfaction was around the fees that lawyers may charge. I couldn't comment on that at all, but it might have been. But the point is, we haven't got this right yet. You can start a business quite easily. You can buy a limited company off the shelf over the internet for less than £100. Yeah, so it is very easy to start a business, and that then involves you as the owner, the director of that company, with a lot of liabilities, as we'll look at in a moment. But the key here is that you need to get as much advice and support as you can. It is very difficult. So what is the sort of first steps you need to be thinking about then? Well, I'm trying to keep going on about this, but getting your idea to bear fruit is hard. It's very, very difficult. In my neck of the woods, which is developing new medicines, it may take 12 years to get a product on the market, and that's particularly challenging. But even in, you know, a less demanding type of business, it can often be very hard to get your products to market and to ensure that people buy enough for you to make a profit and for you to keep growing that business. So you really need some kind of clear understanding of this journey, because I think enterprise is a process. It's not the light bulb moment. It's not, you know, when the bulb goes on. That's kind of, you know, an idea, that's an invention. So entrepreneurs aren't inventors. They're people who are good at enterprise and understand this process of enterprise. And it is a process. So because it's a process, you can break it down into steps, like engineers always do, and you can learn that process and you can teach it. So I would counsel all of you to try and get a good understanding of that process of enterprise. Learn from the experience of others. But most importantly, I think, you need a plan. And it's absolutely vital to have a good plan that takes into account all those things that you can plan for. Because if you don't have a plan, this is what happens. Now, this is one of my favourite graphics of all time. You're looking at essentially a map drawn by Charles Minard sometime after Napoleon's ill-fated march on Moscow. And if you look over at the left-hand side here, just there, look, this thick band coloured light blue, the width of that is proportional to the number of men in the camp. So it says 422,000 men. By the time you add officers' wives, camp followers, there's 500,000 souls here. Now, those souls then head off on this map, heading towards Moscow, and arrive at Moscow sometime later with just 100,000 men. I won't bore you with what happened. Just suffice it to say, not his finest hour. turns round, comes back, and struggles back across the border into Poland with just 10,000 people left. So what happened? Was there a sort of series of battles? Were they all sort of killed in battle? No. Did they all run away? No. What happened was cold weather. They died because of the cold weather. You know, Moscow, winter, not rocket science here. This could have been planned for. And frankly, although you haven't met her, because a certain Eleanor Roosevelt quality, my mother would have had a completely different effect on this campaign. Everybody would have worn a vest, jumper, coats, scarf, gloves, no argument. Last year, she came to this lecture because she was staying with me, which was great fun. And today she called me and she said to me, "Is it cold down there?" And I rashly said, "Yes, it's quite cold." She said, "Are you wearing a vest? I'm 53. Anyway, the point of this is that here is an 80-year-old woman who I genuinely believe could have made a much better job of this than Napoleon. Why? She'd have asked questions. She'd have done the research. Where are you going? What's the weather going to be like? Have you packed your vest? She'd have made a long list, a plan. Now, for her, it's the back of a cornflakes packet that she cuts out and sticks onto the fridge with a magnet. But it's still a list. And it's a prioritised list of things that need to happen. And she ticks them off when they do happen. So she monitors progress against objectives. I mean, this is just business, you know, and it's common sense. Now, do I get hacked off, you know, when she asks me if I'm wearing a vest? No, because, to be honest, I know that my welfare, you know, is behind this. So, naturally, she's thinking about leadership and communication with others whose welfare she's concerned about. Well, that, to me, is about business. I mean, the clue here is in the word company. It's a group of people who are motivated to work together to achieve a common objective. And that's got to be the plan. Now, Napoleon made a complete hash of that, you know, and lost, you know, close on 500,000 souls in the process. I think that graphic is so powerful. It's why I always show anybody who says, "Why do I need to have a plan?" This is why you need to have a plan. Now, swap 500,000 souls and think family home. You're going to lose your family home if you mess up this business and don't plan. And the point is, you've got to be able to plan for the plannable. Plan for those things that you can plan for. So cold weather in Moscow in winter, you could plan for. Because you will need all of your energy in business to deal with those things that you don't plan for, that you couldn't plan for. Some of those will be problematic. Some of those will be fabulous opportunities. So you've got to get rid of all those things you can plan for and put that into this business plan. A little bit more about that later. Now, here, you're in a good position, if you're a member of the university, in terms of getting help for putting that plan together. ISIS Innovation do a great job of helping people who do research to commercialise their intellectual property, and that's the thrust of what I want to focus on tonight. So it's a good place to start, ISIS Innovation. They have good links with funding, finance, business angel networks. More of that a bit later on. So has anybody seen that programme, Dragon's Den? Okay, that's not real life, that's a kind of game show. And I can be rude about them because I know some of the dragons and I know some of the people who've presented. And if you go on that show, you have to walk up a stairs to their den. By the time you get to the top of the stairs, you're out of breath. And then the runner, the researcher, takes the papers off you and says, "Oh, the dragons have changed their mind. You have to go on now and present without your notes." So it's all about trying to make the inventor look a little bit foolish, which I don't really think is something I would support. Anyway, what you've got here is a good mechanism for introducing you to people who can provide funding, and that is absolutely fantastic, and that's one of the great strengths of ISIS. And they can help you with consulting if you want to commercialise IP via routes other than simply starting a business. So there's a number of things they can help you with, and that's great. But it's not just about ISIS. I started working in this area about 15 years ago, and since then, it's grown as a region. It's really well supported. I remember often having to go down to London on the train to find professional advisors who are going to be the right people for the tasks that we needed, especially in the early days with patent attorneys. Now, you've got all of those people surrounding the Oxfordshire community and with the Oxfordshire Bioscience Network. It's a website you should go and have a look at if you're not familiar with it. There is a network of bioscience companies. There are places where you can actually house your company, research parks, incubator facilities, lawyers, human resource advisors. Everything you could possibly need is really within a sort of five-minute drive from the centre of Oxford. So that's a fantastic place to start. And so for those of you who have intellectual property that you're thinking of commercialising, this is a good place to do it. If you are the inventors of that intellectual property, remember that if you've done that under university time, if you're an employee here, then sorry, but the bad news is it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to your employer. So they'll need to think of a mechanism to share in the reward. But equally, you may want to continue being an inventor, to continue being an academic, and that's fine. You don't have to jump ship here, but you will need to pull in people to help you who are good at business, who are good at enterprise. So talking to people who are perhaps doing an MBA here in this building, if you're an inventor, might be a very good place to start. So coming on this course, I think, is a good idea for all sorts of reasons. Now, back then to your good idea. What are you going to sell? Okay, what is it? So the first thing I want you to focus on, what are you going to sell? Okay? That's really, really, really important. The next question is, will anybody want to buy it? And, you know, where is your evidence for that? 15 years ago, when I started doing this, it would maybe cost £15,000 to get a reasonable report done by a market research company to say if anybody would want to buy the things you were thinking of selling. Nowadays, it's all free from the internet. It's fantastic. The internet has changed everything. And certainly there are situations where, during the different times in the academic year, you can ask students to help and provide them with a project, particularly MBA students, with a project to look at your own business idea. So you can get all sorts of free advice and support, again, working with people here. What I want you to focus on is, can you sell your product or service immediately? That's going to be unlikely. You may need to develop it to take it to the next level. You may need to do some, you know, testing in the water. You may need to do quite a bit of significant R&D to get your product even to work. Who knows? So for that, you may need to raise some finance. And you've also got to be thinking about, is your idea protected and can it be protected? And that's terribly important if you want to raise finance to develop intellectual property. So I know you're going to learn more about this as this course progresses, but very simply, here are the key forms of intellectual property to be aware of. First of all, a patent, which is the most obvious one, and that's something you have to apply for. An invention must be novel, inventive, and useful. Certain things you can't patent. Copyright, that arises automatically. So I can see you've got a pen in your hand, and you're probably writing down some things I'm saying, but even though they're my words, what's on that page that you've written, you own copyright over that. So you need to be aware of how copyright works. So, for example, if you engage somebody to design a logo for you as a designer, and you pay them to do that, you haven't actually acquired the copyright at that point. You just pay them to do the work. You have to actually get them to assign the copyright to you. Otherwise, every time you wanted to use that logo, maybe on a business card or a website or a marketing brochure, you'd have to keep paying them. So just a basic understanding of these things is really important in business. And then there's registered design, a kind of look and feel. You know those yellow lemon-shaped plastic containers that contain Jif lemon juice? So that could be, say, a registered design, something that's kind of eye-catching like that, that you associate. And then there's other trademarks. Does anybody hazard a wild guess at how much it cost McDonald's to put TM after Big Mac? Wild guess, anybody? Are you overwhelmed with indifference already? It's only... Well, let me put you out of your misery. Nothing, because it costs nothing. It's not registered. The R in a circle, that's a registered trademark. TM just means that they intend to trademark that at some point in the future. It avoids this concept of passing off. The first trademark was the red triangle that goes on Bass beer, so that people who were illiterate could actually get the beer they wanted just by seeing the triangle on the label and not get inferior beer. So if somebody else put a red triangle on their beer and it was inferior beer, that would be passing off. So the point about TM is that if you were to then think of a name for your product I really don't care what you think of it, just think of one. I mean, call it Kevin if you want to, but then put TM after it. In the business plan, when the bank manager reads that, I'm guessing that he or she probably doesn't know you haven't got a registered trademark. Just guessing. I couldn't possibly recommend that, but nevertheless, you might consider it. It might impress the hell out of bankers. I couldn't possibly comment. So an understanding of how these things work is really important. And the bottom one is really, really, really important. Confidential information, know-how. I think I'm right in saying that the Coca-Cola recipe isn't protected anywhere. They just don't tell anybody how to make it. It's confidential know-how. And this is nothing new. I mean, we tend to think in technology transfer and patent attorneys and all that stuff, that this is new, that we've invented this. Not a bit of it. Medieval trade guilds were doing this hundreds of years ago. My father, who was a bound apprentice as a joiner, a carpenter, and I've got his deeds of indenture, which were torn in half. Half were kept by the master and half were kept by my father's father, my grandfather. It starts off by saying, I promise not to divulge my master's secrets. And it goes on to say that if he does, his master had the right to beat him. I think employment law has gone downhill a bit since those days, but there we are. But the point is, it's really important. You've got to take steps to keep it secret. Going back to why plumbers are wealthy, if this was a leaking radiator in your house, and say there's a valve on it that's leaking, the plumber doesn't say, just come and have a look at this and I'll show you what's wrong and how to fix it, so next time this happens, you don't need to call. You know, they don't say that. They keep that knowledge to themselves. So trying to keep this information confidential is really, really important. It's something that you can sell. Now, some people sell their know-how by becoming employees. And no matter how valuable that information is to their employer, they sign something called a contract of employment where the employer pays them exactly the same salary every month. And no matter how successful the business is on the basis of the know-how they share, they still get paid the same amount. How does that work? I can't. Has anybody seen the film The Matrix? I think it's similar. So, genuinely, an understanding of this, you don't have to be an expert here, but an understanding is really, really helpful. So we then come to technology transfer, the sort of name which universities in particular tend to think about in terms of commercialising IP. The most obvious one, dead easy, know-how and consultancy, that can be done very easily whereby an academic with know-how can sell that knowledge to a third party, perhaps a large company. Perhaps you have a good single idea, which can be patented, and that's good. But a single patent, a single idea might not be enough to form a company around. It may be just a good idea that you license to a pre-existing company to commercialise. But then there may be a family of patents, and that might be something that, where there's multiple related ideas, then you can build a company around that. And that might be a spin-out company. So, again, I think licences are perhaps obvious for a single patent, licences too for multiple patents, but perhaps you've got an opportunity there for a spin-out company if that's of interest to you. So what is this spin-out company? Well, I'm not a lawyer, but lawyers tell me to think of a company like a human being. And like a human being, a company can own property, including intellectual property. And a company will have certain rights, and that's terribly important. A limited company, a private limited company is what we're talking about here, the one where the name followed by LTD, not PLC, that's something different. A limited company, and this is where you have shares in the company. You need shares in the company in order to sell them to people to raise money for equity finance, which we'll look at a bit later. And the company itself is owned by the shareholders, so you may be a shareholder in a company, but you may have nothing to do with the management of the company. You may be a director of a company, and you may have no shares in the company, so you may not own it. Or you may be both. If you founded the company, chances are you'll have shares, and you'll also be a director. So there's different ways of looking at this, but make sure you understand shareholders own the company, directors run it. So it's really, really important. And the board of directors is a sort of fancy title. You need one director for a limited company in the UK now. It used to be two offices, but you're no longer for a small company, you're a company secretary. So one person can actually get this going. And, you know, I would when you're starting up, tend to use sensible titles. Chief Executive Officer is a bit grand if you've just started up a company in your bedroom. It does impress bank managers and others, but nevertheless, you know, just be sensible about the titles that you tend to use. So, in all of this then, you've got some duties if you are a director of this company, and those duties are pretty serious. This is not just about, if you go wrong, going to sit on the naughty step. This is about prison, which I'm given to understand is like a bad thing. So do not go there. Ensure that you fulfil all your obligations if you become a director. So if a friend says to you, will you sit on my company as a director? I value your advice. You go, that's fine, but be aware of the responsibilities you're taking on. It's a bit like becoming a governor at a school, far more serious now than it was a few years ago. So you have to act in good faith in the best interest of the company if you're a director. That means not in your own interest. It means not what will make you money, but what's in the best interest of all shareholders. And so there may be a conflict there. Be aware of that. You've got to keep accounts, which is really important, which is not difficult. Basically, take the bank statement every month, look at what went in and what came out, and do some simple bookkeeping. That's all you have to do. But you do have to file accounts at Companies House. But you mustn't trade insolvently. Now, that's not the same thing as going into debt. Trading insolvently means that you don't have the chance as a company to actually get the money to pay your bills as they arise. If you believe that investors will keep putting money into your business, that's fine. So you may be making a loss every year because you're spending their money, but you're not trading insolvently. So trading insolvently is what you mustn't do. And again, that would be something that you may have to go to prison for. Insurance can help, but it doesn't keep you out of jail. But nevertheless, be aware of insurance, and there are a number of forms. Key person. So if you've got an inventor associated with your company, it may be yourself, then what would you do if the inventor was run over by the proverbial bus? You know, would you need to hire a whole load of people to fill that woman's shoes? So what are you going to do? Can you insure that? Yes, you can take out something called key person insurance. So that's one thing. Next thing is what's often called D&O, director and officer's liability. This is where money will come forward to defend you as a director and officer of the company. If something happens which wasn't really your fault, but nevertheless somebody's bringing a lawsuit against you. So that will help with that. Buildings and contents, pretty obvious. Employees' liability, public liability, product liability. All of those things will be appropriate in some shape or form. But don't go to your bank, because I bank with Barclays, but I wouldn't go to them to ask about insurance, because they'd most likely sell me Barclays insurance products. So always go to an independent financial advisor, an IFA. And there's a website where you can find one. Just Google IFA. There are lots in Oxford, actually. Now, like it or not, the taxman's going to become your new best friend. You'll be seeing a lot of the taxman, and you'll be working for them in an unpaid capacity for however long you are running a business. You'll have responsibilities to collect tax, to hold tax back. So when you pay employees, you keep the income tax back. You also have the pleasure of paying employers income tax, national insurance, and so forth in all of this. You've also got to take VAT from customers. There's corporation tax at the end of the year. The good news is R&D tax credit. If you're putting money into R&D, you can claim some of that back, and that's good. But the really good news is the two next bits. Has anybody previously heard of the Enterprise Investment Scheme? No, not a great show of hands. Anybody heard of the Enterprise Management Scheme, EMI? Okay, well, these are schemes whereby if the company is sold in due course and shareholders make a profit, they have to pay less tax if those shares are registered under EIS and EMI. And the real benefit for investors, for private investors, is that they get a tax break when they invest in an EIS qualifying company, and they get a tax break when they sell those shares in a few years' time at a profit. So they get two bites of the cherry. So the first question any private business angel investor will ask you is, does this business qualify for EIS? Not a question you ever hear on Dragon's Den, but that's the one thing they want to know. Now, there are some simple rules that you have to follow. The company must not, for example, be a subsidiary of another company. Otherwise, it's not really an innovative, enterprising thing. It's just a part of a bigger empire. And then you've got to get advice about planning your own tax affairs, including capital gains tax all round. So you need good advice around all of this. And so that brings us to the next thing, professional advisors. Top of the list, in my view, is the accountant. You've got to have an accountant. Okay, this isn't negotiable. You have to have an accountant. Okay? I think your accountant will save you more in tax than she charges you in her fees. If she doesn't, fire and get somebody else. But generally speaking, they are worth their weight in gold. They're also valuable for a number of other reasons. One, they see business plans and the associated budgets, usually called cash flow forecasts, every day of their working lives. You will forget things in your plan, in your cash flow forecast. They'll spot them by just flicking through it for 10 minutes. So use them as an advisor. They're not bookkeepers. Don't take them a shoebox full of receipts at the end of the year and expect them to save you money. They're professionals, and use them as professional advisors. I think in the early days, meet with your accountant at least once a quarter. That's probably sensible. And they also handle PAYE, pay as you earn. It's a very complicated process of deductions that you have to make, not just for yourselves, but for any employees that you may have. Very complicated things that apply to all of that. You know, don't do it. You know, why would you want to waste your time doing that when an accountant will charge you, on average, about £6 per employee per month to calculate it for you and create the paperwork and the, you know, the monthly pay slip and all the forms that you need to file it with the tax man. So, you know, get them to do this work for you, and you will then be able to spend time running your business. So don't be a sort of bookkeeper stroke PAYE calculating person. It's just not worth it. You need lawyers, and if you have a limited company where you're seeking equity finance through the sale of shares, you need something called a shareholder agreement. This isn't a DIY document. You need an experienced corporate lawyer to draw that up for you. But they've done it hundreds of times before, so they have a draft that just needs tweaking and amending. So they're probably not going to charge you a fortune starting from scratch. Bankers, human resources, public relations, business support networks, if you're from a technology background, maybe a scientific advisory board, all of those people can be put in place before you start trading. All of those people can be referred to in your business plan. If you identify a lawyer and say to them, can I put in my business plan that you will agree to act for me once I start trading? Of course, they'll be delighted to do that. But when you go to the bank with this plan, looking for finance, and you've got all these people in place, it shows that you've already built your team. It's not a sign of weakness. I think it's a sign of strength that you're able to show in this document. You know you need all these people, and you've already identified them. So it's not just your employees, but also your network of advisors. And you've put them in place, which is terribly important. So if we're thinking about a spin-out then, a company launched from a university to commercialise intellectual property, who owns it? Well, it varies from university to university, but this is not unusual. This might be typical. I think this works quite well. Basically, we say half the company is going to go to the team behind the invention. So 50% is split between the inventor and the employer, the university. And then the rest we split between people putting in investment and the management team. So people putting in investment is the equity, so maybe 35% equity for startup funding, and maybe 15% equity to a share option scheme. Now, share options are really good because it's a scheme whereby you can say, if you come and work for this company, I'll grant you 1,000 share options at today's price, and in 3 years you can sell them at whatever price they're trading at, but you only have to pay today's price. So the person doesn't need to do anything, doesn't need to pay anything. It's just a bit of paper that gives them the right, hopefully, if all goes well, to make money in, say, 3 years' time. So it's a good way of attracting good people into your company and keeping them within your company as well, since they can't trade for the first 3 years. The structure here, nobody owns more than 50%, so it certainly qualifies for EIS. And although there are minority rights, they can be protected within a shareholder agreement, and that's important. Now, who thinks they own this company? Well, funnily enough, the inventor, who says, look, I've been at this university for 20 years now. I've received millions of pounds in research grants from research councils. I've put this international team of experts together. You know, you pay me very little as a university. You know, this is my company. I'm the one who's got the name on the patents. You know, I've done all of this. Without me, there would be no company. And the university says, well, okay, but without us putting a roof over your head and giving you the opportunity to do what you've been doing, you wouldn't have been able to build this team. And furthermore, it's very simple. The law says that the employer owns the IP, not the employee. So hard luck. And then the investors say, well, you're just like mad academics. What the hell do you know about business? This is my money. I've sweated, you know, long and hard to get this cash. If you want me to invest in this business, then, you know, matey, it's my business. I'm in charge here. And then the management team, kind of arrogant people like me, come in and say, well, okay, that's as maybe. But actually, what's going to deliver here is the people who can get you from where you are now to where you want to be in a few years' time. And that's me. So the management team thinks they're in charge. So basically, everybody thinks they're in charge. Now, that's okay, but the problem occurs when all of the directions they're pulling in is like the four points of a compass, you know? It can be very problematic. I've never seen blood on the carpet in board meetings, but I've held jackets. You know, it's quite problematic. So the solution to this is to put together a plan, a business plan, and a cash flow forecast, a budget, that everybody can buy into. So that's kind of like a contract between the various parties. The inventor and the university says, yeah, we're going to license the IP to this company because your plan, we like what you're going to do with it. The investor says, well, we're going to buy shares in this because, you know, if we put the money in and you spend the money in this way, then that's good. And the management team don't have to keep going back for approval every 5 minutes because it says what they're going to do and what the budget is. So they've already got that nailed. So a business plan, a cash flow forecast, really important. But it's not a dead document. It's a living document. It can change and be adapted and modify and evolve probably every month in a small way, every quarter in a medium way, and perhaps every year in a major way. So it's a living document, but it's a management tool because it's what the management team, it might just be you, need to use to manage this business. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's how much it's going to cost. Here's how I'm going to do it. Here's what I'm going to do it by. And if you can deliver objectives in a plan on time and within a budget, you'll get funding the next time. If you can't do it, you won't get funding the next time. It's just dead simple. Ergo, the only rule in business is don't run out of cash. So that's really, really important. So I think then the business plan is the key thing here. And down the bottom, use whatever funding is raised to deliver objectives and milestones that you've captured in the plan and do it on time and within the budget. So what is this plan? Well, it's not some PhD thesis. It's not. It's a 30-page document, and it's a single page for the executive summary. Don't write five-page executive summaries. That's not a summary. That's a small plan. So don't do that. Now, Barbara mentioned that I write for a paper. I never had any training as a journalist in my life, but I can tell a story in 400 words because I'm good at writing executive summaries to persuade investors to put money into my companies. And that's entirely, I think, why I write for The Independent. It's that practice that's been useful. So you've got to get some practice in getting your story nailed in 400 words, in one page. It's like the elevator pitch in Hollywood, you know, where you've got an idea for a story, you get in for film, you get into the elevator and, you know, oh joy, you're standing next to some big Hollywood magnate who might be a producer to put the money into your idea. You've got from the ground floor to the 12th floor to pitch your idea. If you can't do that, you won't get the cash. The same with the executive summary. I have to tell you that of the business plans that you use for raising finance like this, some investors may not read the whole plan. But they will definitely read the executive summary page, and they'll definitely read the cash flow forecast page. And we don't want pages and pages of Excel spreadsheets. I want one page per year. Columns for the months, rows, early ones, money coming in. What am I spending money on? And what's the delta? What's the difference? Where's the position at the bank? So very simple, very straightforward. And it's not because investors aren't clever people. They're jolly clever people because they've made their money in business because they're clever people. The tax man had money from, you know, the landed gentry generations ago. These are clever people. But they can read your plan. If they feel you can get your ideas across in one page, either numerically with the cash flow forecast or in the written word with the executive summary, they'll be persuaded that you can communicate to people who may then buy things from you. Communicate to your staff to get them to deliver what's in the business plan. So this communication box that they're going to tick is really important. And finally, investors often will tear out the executive summary. It says confidential, do not copy. So they'll tear that out and they'll stick it on their fax machine and maybe send it to half a dozen of their pals and say, look, this person's looking to raise 350,000. What about all seven of us put in 50,000? I could tell you, and this is one of those things that you learn in real life that you don't get in textbooks, and it sounds bonkers, but it's true. If there are two pages, they can't be bothered to stand there and fax them through. So make it easy for people. Single page, really, really important for all sorts of reasons. With a business plan, I think, you know, don't over-egg the pudding, but I do recommend that you have something that's interesting. I have four sons. Nice young fellow on that magazine cover, dyslexia, something I'm interested in. So I'd be inclined to pick that up if it was in a, you know, doctor's surgery or something, a waiting room, and read it. The business plan front cover on the left is something I've replicated, but it's a real one. It's out of date, and there's a typo on the front page. Why would I pick that up and read it and be compelled to invest? I wouldn't. But the telling thing in all of this is a friend of mine who's an analyst in the city, so she gets lots of opportunities in front of fair. And I said, how many do you get? She said, oh, well, loads. I said, well, how do you choose which ones to go through in detail? Oh, I read the ones that look good. I read the ones that look good. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, you know, colour, pictures. I said, you must be joking. You know, you could be missing really good opportunities. And she said, yeah, but that doesn't matter. I said, well, why not? She said, because today I've got 50 on my desk and tomorrow I'll have 50 new ones. So the truth of the matter is that 98% of business propositions that go forward for finance don't get it. So you've got to be in the 2% that does. So start by at least having a professional front cover on the blinking plan. That would be a good thing. You've got to get noticed. Don't over-egg the pudding, but at least get noticed and be professional. Now, in terms of valuation, this is more of a kind of art than science. And in the current climate, which is challenging, there may be sentiment which is driving this very strongly. And investors may think, well, I'm just not going to invest in something where they're claiming it's got a value of more than a million. So if you're selling 35%, the most you can raise is 350,000. So again, this is where independent information, perhaps done by an MBA team at a university business school, not dissimilar to this one, can actually be very, very helpful in persuading investors as to why your business has a value. It could be against future revenue. If you're not raising money with a business that's currently trading, you don't have any predictions there from real numbers, you've got to base this on a proposition. And so that can be supported by independent things. Where'd you get all of this money from? Well, you can borrow it, some debt finance, but banks have hardly covered themselves in glory in recent years in terms of enterprise, and they're not the place to get money from in business. My son, 28, still lives at home, oh joy, could get a credit card tomorrow with a £15,000 limit. Do you think he could get a business loan for £15,000 for a new business without mum and dad underwriting it? Not a cat in hell's chance. Why? Because they take different approaches and different attitudes. However, one glimmer of hope in all of this is something called the Enterprise Finance Guarantee Scheme. It used to be called the Small Firms Loan Guarantee Scheme. It's a government underwritten scheme whereby if you don't have the security with which to underwrite your own loan, to secure your own loan, like a house, that's a typical form of security. If you're a young person, you don't yet have a house, then the government will step in and underwrite 75% of that loan for you. Gone are the days when the banks require your first loan for security. You now understand why I have four sons. It gives me some flexibility around borrowing. However, business angels are the group to turn to equity finance in this area for university-based spin-out companies. High net worth individuals maybe invest $25,000 up to $250,000, and they're a really, really important group. Sometimes they also work with venture capital trusts. Not the same thing as venture capital companies. Venture capital trusts are professionally managed pots of money where private high net worth individuals put money into that pot. So to get the cash, what do they want to know? Okay, what do they want to know? Well, first of all, obvious stuff, that there's a strong commercial application, that you've got something that's going to sell. The good thing is, if you're a university spin-out type of thing, that you've got the credibility of the university behind you. The bad thing is, you've got the university behind you. They think you're academics and not salespeople. So you've got to persuade them, or your management team has to persuade them, that somebody is going to buy this and that they're going to pay the money that you need to charge in order to make a profit. It's protected, so patents. Most important is that the management team is capable of delivering. So if you're a brilliant academic with a fantastic invention that's patented, marvellous, but find a world-class manager to match your world-class science, please. That's the best way of having a world-class business. Don't try and do this in a DIY way. Also, you need this clear exit strategy about how you will sell the business in due course. How do you find good managers? Well, are researchers good managers? The answer is sometimes, but not always. You know, it may well be that, in any case, the best thing for the inventor to do is to keep inventing, because the more inventions they come up with, the more products perhaps this company can have to sell. So you might not want them to be tied up with management. So I think you've got to find ways of getting this management team together. But here there's a catch-22. To raise the money, you need the right management team in place. But the problem is, you know, you won't get the money without the right management team, and you won't attract the high-quality managers unless you've got the money to pay them. So it's a tricky one, a really tricky one. What I call the kind of management catch-22 here. So what are the options? Well, you could hire somebody who's not very good, who's cheaper. I don't think that's the best option. I really don't. You could offer a good CEO, a good managing director, a good manager, a salary that's lower than market rates, but you could load that with some share options and saying if the company's successful, we're going to give you some shares now and some further shares in the company. And if the company is successful and you've built it up and you've made it successful, when it's sold, you will share in that success. I think that's a good way to approach it. Or you can use an interim manager. Now, by interim manager, I don't mean interim manager sometimes is like a code word for redundant. That's not what we're thinking about here. This is a specialist group who don't want to have a real job. Right? There is no rule in law that says you have to work 9 to 5 5 days a week and Saturday mornings if you work in a shoe shop. There is no law that says that. There's a law that says you can't work more hours than so many per week. But employees, and here's the Matrix movie again, somehow think they have to work 5 days a week, 9 to 5, but that's just for the convenience of everybody. It doesn't have to be like that. And if you're launching a new business, you do not have to work 5 days a week. I think 2 days a week is probably enough from somebody who knows what they're doing, who are good. Would you dream of going to your lawyer and saying, I'm thinking of starting a business. Would you please now work for me for 5 days a week? No, you would automatically think of them as a professional advisor. So think then of the management team, more like professional advisors. You don't need them there 5 days a week. Think about using somebody who's good for a limited number of time. Okay? Now, what might the strategy be? Well, you bring in this interim as part of a founding team. And that individual might raise, you know, 300,000, half a million, that kind of thing. Spend that money making progress against the objectives you've written in your plan, those milestones. And because they've made progress, then clearly the company is worth more. So the share price goes up. And believe it or not, investors will, generally speaking, buy new shares that you issue at the higher price to maintain their percentage. It's something called preemption rights. But you may also bring in new investors to bring in new sources of cash. So the key thing in all of this, really, is to make progress with the company. and then perhaps the interim manager replaces themselves with a full-time person after maybe 2 years. And that full-time person may be really focused on commercial stuff and really, really good at talking to people in the city. You know, can actually meet with venture capital people without feeling they're dealing with Satan. You know? So really important to get the right person in place at the right time. And I don't think you need the startup person 3 years later, because the startup person has a different set of skills. They may enjoy not sailing close to the wind, but the excitement of the early days. They may enjoy building this. I mentioned to you earlier that my father is a carpenter, and I could actually make a boat, a small one, from wood. I could actually make one, but I couldn't sail it to save my life. And I think the truth of the matter is you need different people to build the ship and different people to sail them. And equally, when you come to get into the commercial phase of the company, maybe after 3 years or whatever it is, where it's all about sell, 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 selling the same thing again and again and again, there are some people, believe it or not, who really get excited about meeting targets of selling double glazing that month. Yeah? That's fine. You know, that's not what turns me on, I have to say. So different people at different stages. So I think you need to think about succession planning in the company, and not that you start this company and you stay there for life. It's something you build, and then you may move on and do the next one, or you do the next three, whatever it turns out to be. So in these funding rounds, then, that I've mentioned, where the share price is going up, you've got to be able to measure progress. And so if you can hit objectives and milestones in your plan, you must be worth more than before you did that. So your share price arguably has gone up. So that's how you achieve that. And the document, therefore, the business plan, is really, really, really important. It's not just something that you give to a bank manager to agree an overdraft. It's how you're going to run the company. So creating the plan is terribly important. So I would have to say that, in my experience, it's fantastic fun. It's hugely scary sometimes. It can be very lonely doing it. And it's actually, when you're raising finance, quite different from what you might think. These shareholders who are going to put money into your company by buying shares in your company, it's almost quite an intimate thing. I remember the first check I ever did for a spin-out from this university. The investor arrived at my house at about 8:30 on a Sunday morning, unannounced. And luckily I was sitting in working, and my wife said, "Oh, this is so-and-so here to see you." And he came to me, and he handed me the check, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "You are going to spend this wisely, aren't you?" Translation: I know where you live. You know, so it's not what you think. But genuinely, nor are they dragons. They really are business angels. Why would they not want to help you make your business successful if they actually own part of it? So I always think of them as money plus the little black book, or their contacts, people they know, and the advice that they can give you. So they do often want to help you. But equally, there is a kind of gamesmanship when raising money from investors to be aware of. Firstly, they may ask you the trick question: how much money will I make when we come to sell the company? Which I think it's against the law for you to answer. You have to use phrases like, you know, the value of your investments may go up and may go down, all that stuff. So you don't answer it at all. But you might say, well, I couldn't possibly comment on that, but a similar company recently was sold for. So you come armed with lots of information, but not give them sort of these guarantees. But very importantly, the thing I would end on, if you are any of you thinking of selling a share, is set a price and stick to it. It's not like on Dragon's Den, where the inventor says, "I would like to raise £500,000, releasing 30% of the company." And one of the dragons says, "Well, I'll offer you £100,000 for 51% of the company." You know, I think that's time for baseball to visit Mr. Kneecap. It's not how it works. And if you go home tonight after this and you call it the fish and chip shop and you say, "Could I have haddock, chips and mushy peas, my favourite?" And the person behind the counter says, "That'll be £6.32. You don't say, "You know what, I was thinking more £3.47. Yeah, that's not how it works. So I would say, do your research, set the share price. Now, you're going to have to kiss a lot of frogs to find the prince, but but nevertheless be prepared to stick to it. So for that, to have that confidence, you need to take advice. So at least tonight, that's the first bit, hopefully, of taking some helpful advice. We're just about on 7:30, so thanks for your attention and good luck in your business.